Well, this may be the last cold day of this season. It's been very cold compared to yesterday and what they're forecasting for the next, well, indefinite springtime and summer. But we'll have to wait and see about that. For today's study, it's February 29th, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 19:22 hours Eastern Time. Ward Green with you. The Crucible of Credible Creed, Chapter 7, Paragraph 8, is what we're studying. Oh, I just realized we need to make the width more appropriate there. So here we are. We'll see how it looks. Paragraph 8. Oh, it looks good. The Bible relates that both Abraham and Isaac had occasion, Isaac being the son of Abraham, and they both had the occasion to live in a city called Gerar, located near coastal Gaza. Brown Driver Briggs, which is a Hebrew dictionary, defines Gerar as a lodging place, in quotes, a lodging place. Gerar is said, I think it's Gerar, though, because of the way it's spelled. Let's see if we can find out how it's spelled. It's Genesis chapter 20. Genesis 20. Gerar, it's how it's accented. So Abraham moved to the land of the Negev, which I believe the word Negev might mean south or something like that, but it's the desert south of Israel. And he took up dwelling between Kadesh and Shur, and residing as an alien at Gerar. Kadesh was the place from which the Israelites spied out the land when they were coming back from Egypt, sometime after Abraham's day. So let's just continue with our reading in the Crucible article for now. Our study in the Proverbs will be a little later. Gerar is said to be in the Negev Desert. It's a desert in South Canaan. But I think the word Negev means south, if I recall correctly, which would explain the name Negev, because it is south of Jerusalem and in the south of Canaan. So the Targum of Jonathan refers to Gerar at Genesis 21 as Gerariku, the same form as in the Jewish Talmud. Sir Lancelot Brenton's Septuagint translation prefers the name Gerara for this place, whilst the British Methodist theologian Mr. Clark calls it, quote, city of a quote, city of Arabia Petraea, end quote. And while I'm at it, I just realized trying to silence these hard drives would be a good idea. Here we go. That's going to make some better silence. And while I'm doing that, I can turn off my speaker in case it's producing a little bit of a noise. There we go. And turn off the hard drives, the ones that are making the most noise. Isn't that quieter now? According to BiblePlaces.com, Gerar is generally, quote, accepted as the site, end quote, known today as Tel Haror. You see the similarity? Or Tel Haror, Haror and Gerar. Tel Abu Huraira. is the same name as Tel Haror, or Tel Haror, Tel Abu Huraira. As we have learned already in this chapter, Abraham's time was a time of drought and famine, as Isaac's time was too. So it is hardly. I'm just trying to take shortcuts because I know I need to blow my nose here, I think. Right, we had a power outage last night. It went on for at least 6, 8, maybe 8 hours even. And I was not knowing if I'd have to start my generator or how long it would go on. And that caused me to be quite unsettled, you know, and I was unable to sleep last night, so I had another nap of approximately four hours this afternoon. But as we have learned already in this chapter, Abraham's time was a time of drought and famine, as Isaac's time was too. So it is hardly surprising that the nomadic life prevailed in Canaan in the years 2200 to 2000 BCE. So we even have in our theory here of there being a colder climate, which explained also the fact that there was a famine. And that, you know, the food wasn't, there apparently wasn't rainfall, you know, it was drought, and there wasn't, but we don't know about the drought, all we know about is the famine. So for whether it was colder and therefore things weren't growing, or whether it was a dry period, I don't think we know that, but I'm not sure why. The reason I say that is because I'm not sure why a period of cold weather would be a period of drought, seeing as we get a lot of rain during the colder weather today. So I'm not sure about the drought part of it, but we know that it was, according to the research of more than one discipline of science, has shown this, that there was a time of, well, no, we also saw that there was drought. That's right, in the different branches of science that were used, the stalagmites in the caves, which are obtained by the dripping of water downwards to form stalagmites that grow upward in the cave, right? They grow up. During a period of drought, they wouldn't form because there wouldn't be as much dripping. They wouldn't form at as high a rate. But they were able to determine it was a time of drought from various research, and then other research obtained also the depth of the lake in the Fayum region of Egypt, which we also saw, I mentioned in the article, showed that it was a time of drought around the time of Abraham and Isaac in our chronology. The chronology being what determined when Abraham and Isaac were living. But we also saw that the icebergs and the research of the ash on the bed of the ocean correlated to the icebergs determined that it was also an ice age in these years 2200 to 2000. But that is remarkable because it explains why the nomadic life prevailed in Canaan in the time of Abraham and Isaac. They were traveling around as nomads, and before this research we had no explanation for why the traveling life, except for we knew there were famines, so they had to travel because of the famine to find food. And we know that it's generally agreed that in those years of Abraham and Isaac, that God's people at least were nomads. And we've now put the date as 2200 to 2000 BCE, but we've confirmed it with independent scientific research that had nothing to do with the Bible, and still confirmed the Bible. People moved during that time readily through the land searching for food. The earliest evidence for a city at Gerar is therefore not a steadfast indicator for the correctness of the location, since people were living in tents as part of nomadic life. Yet a temple found at Tel Haror was dated about 1700 BCE, sometime late, much later, in fact, 500 years later than Abraham. The king of Gerar in the Bible is named Abimelech, who was said to be a king of the Philistines, and this name has an apparent similarity to Abimilku, king of Tyre, whose name arises in the Amarna letters, circa 1362 to 1332 BCE, again much later. The Philistines or Peliset people, look at the correspondence, Philistine and Peliset, very similar words. So, as the Peliset people, they're known as sea people. And that's why the Philistines, of course, lived in the coastal cities. They were sea people. And the Mediterranean Sea is the, quote, sea of the Philistines, end quote. They were seagoing people, so they lived near the Mediterranean. Gaza is an early Bronze Age city, EBA, early Bronze Age, circa 3300 to 2100 BCE is the early Bronze Age dating. And since Gaza is also a city in which the Philistines lived, or the Peliset people, in that region. So that's phenomenally important, because this early Bronze Age city dates to around the time of Abraham there. But I mean, of course, Gaza has survived much longer than that. It means that it was a thriving city during the early Bronze Age, also, which was even the time preceding Abraham. The town's situation, meaning its location, and the name of the king, given in the Bible, Abimelech, lend the Gerar account signs of historical accuracy, because we know the name Abimilku arose later as the king of Tyre as well, which is typical of kings' names. They were passed on and so on. Sometimes it was a title rather than a name, but we might have thought of it as a name. But all of the evidence shows that the Bible is very historical, and so is the Gerar account. Proverbs chapter 20, verse 3 is our proverb, little children, for today. It is a glory for a man to desist from disputing, but everyone foolish will burst out in it. Talking about unity, that's a good scripture for that conversation. 1 Chronicles 19, and it came about afterward that Nahash, the king of the sons of Ammon, came to die, and his son began to reign in place of him. At that David said, I shall exercise loving kindness toward Hanan, the son of Nahash, because his father exercised loving kindness toward me. Accordingly, David sent messengers to comfort him over his father. And the servants of David proceeded to come into the land of the sons of Ammon to Hanan, to comfort him. However, the princes of the sons of Ammon said to Hanan, is David honoring your father in your eyes, in that he has sent comforters to you? Is it not for the sake of making a thorough search and causing an overthrow and spying out the land that his servants have come to you? So Hanan took the servants of David and shaved them and cut their garments in half to their buttocks and sent them away. Later, people went and told David about the men, and he at once sent to meet them because they had become men very much humiliated, and the king went on to say, "Dwell in Jericho until your beards grow abundantly." Of course, they could replace their garments with other garments, but they couldn't grow their beards instantaneously. And in those days, it was evidently a shame to have no beard. "Then you must return." In time, the sons of Ammon saw that they had become foul-smelling to David. Well, no wonder, because of the way that they had treated David's servants. And Hanan and the sons of Ammon proceeded to send 1,000 silver talents to hire for themselves chariots and horsemen from Mesopotamia and from Aramaica and from Zobah. Thus they hired for themselves 32,000 chariots and the king of Maica and his people. And in the Insight book, it says, under Aram, that Aramaica is mentioned along with Zobah, Rehob, and Ishtob as among the Aramean kingdoms from which the Ammonites hired chariots and horsemen to war against David. The king of Aramaica joined these mercenary forces, which David's army soon put to flight. The kingdom of Maica probably lay east of the Jordan, with Mount Hermon on its north side. Then they came in and camped before Medeba, and as for the sons of Ammon, they gathered together from their cities and now came in for the war. When David heard of it, he immediately sent Joab and all the army and the mighty men, and the sons of Ammon began to go out and draw up in battle formation at the entrance of the city, and the kings that had come were by themselves in the open field. When Joab saw that the battle charges had come to be against him from the front and from the rear, he at once chose some of all the choice men in Israel and drew them up in formation to meet the Syrians. Here they're called Syrians, interestingly. So the word Syria can sometimes be used concurrently with the word, or as synonymous with the word Assyria also. Because, east of the Jordan is not Syria as we know it today. At least it's more north of Israel, the land of Syria, that as we know it today. But east of the Jordan, we get into the, once we cross the Euphrates River, for example, then we get into Assyria. See if we have instruction here. Doesn't have any reference there. Maybe there's a cross reference here. Not what I'm looking for, anyway. Let's see. They're called Syrians, whereas when we looked up here, they were from Mesopotamia, which is across the Jordan, typically, although the word Mesopotamia can mean other things. It says in the Insight book, under Mesopotamia, evidence for the broad usage of the designation Mesopotamia is found in the book of Acts, chapter 7, verse 2, where Stephen spoke of Abraham as residing in Mesopotamia, while in Babylonia, but it says it is not possible to establish with certainty whether the Hebrew Aram-Naharaim likewise included Babylonia, because Aram-Naharaim, or Aram, was north of Israel, not that far east as Babylonia is, which is quite, it's 3 hours. I'm thinking it's 3 hours east, but maybe that's not true. Is it true? Trying to think, is it 3 hours east? Or am I thinking, I know that Jerusalem's 3 hours east of Greenwich. I'm trying to think. Babylonia might be even in the same time zone as Israel. I can't remember precisely. but we'll look that up when we need to know it. Whenever there's a basis for determining the general geographic location, the northern area around Hayran is included under Aram Naharaim, which means land between the rivers, apparently. Aram Naharaim means Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia means, I think, between the two rivers. That's what Meso is, the middle. And Potamia, I think, has to do with the rivers. There are rivers on both sides of Mesopotamia, such as the Euphrates on one side, and other rivers on the other side. When Joab saw that the battle charges, first of all, we've read that. And the rest of the people, verse 11, he gave into the hand of Abishai, his brother, that they might draw up in formation to meet the sons of Ammon. And he went on to say, if the Syrians become too strong for me, you must also serve as a salvation for me. But if the sons of Ammon themselves become too strong for you, I must also save you. Be strong that we may show ourselves courageous in behalf of our people and in behalf of the cities of our God. And as for Jehovah, what is good in his own eyes he will do. And then Joab and the people that were with him advanced before the Syrians to the battle, and they took to flight from before him. As for the sons of Ammon, they saw that the Syrians had fled, and they themselves also took to flight from before Abishai, his brother, and then came into the city. Later Joab came into Jerusalem. The men who took to flight came into a different city from Jerusalem, obviously. When the Syrians saw that they had been defeated before Israel, they proceeded to send messengers and bring out the Syrians that were in the region of the river, meaning the Euphrates River, with Shophak, the chief of the army of Hadadezer, before them. When the report was made to David, he immediately gathered all Israel together and crossed the Jordan and came to them and drew up in formation against them. When David drew up in battle formation to meet the Syrians, my throat tickling. Just a like a dust cough or an allergy maybe there's a little bit of smoke still here from last night from the fire I was burning in the wood stove. And David went killing of the Syrians 7,000 charioteers as the Syrians took to flight because of Israel, and 40,000 men on foot he killed, and Shophak, the chief of the army himself, he put to death. When the servants of Hadadezer saw that they had been defeated before Israel, it's rather difficult to fight when you're running away, they promptly made peace with David and began to serve him in Syria. Did not want to try saving the sons of Ammon anymore. That's the end of 1 Chronicles 19. Now Hadadezer was, let's see what we have there. The army of Hadadezer. I'm sure I looked this up. Under Hadadezer. Right. Syrians from the region of the Euphrates. It is referred to in the Insight book under Hadadezer. Anyway, he was evidently an Assyrian. That's what we learned from that. But we have to move on for today and study the book of Hosea chapter 8 now, so that we don't run out of time. To your mouth, it says, 8 and 1 of Hosea, to your mouth a horn. One comes like an eagle against the house of Jehovah for the reason that they have overstepped my covenant, and against my law they have transgressed. So this is at a different time entirely from David, but it relates well to what we just read about the enemy coming against Israel. To me, they keep crying, "Oh my God, we, Israel, have known you." But Jehovah says, "Israel has cast off good. Let one who is an enemy pursue him. They themselves have set up kings, but not because of me. They have set up princes, but I did not know it. With their silver and their gold, they have made for themselves idols to the end that they may be cut off." This is talking about the northern kingdom. "Your calf has been cast off, O Samaria. My anger has grown hot against them. How long will they be incapable of innocency? For from Israel was even this. A mere craftsman made it, and it is not God, because the calf of Samaria will become mere splinters." They had built this calf and covered it with gold, and it was an idol god that they used in the northern kingdom of Israel to worship idols instead of Jehovah. So their kings were unauthentic. They were illegitimate, according to Jehovah. Verse 7, "For it is wind that they keep sowing, and a storm wind is what they will reap. Nothing has standing grain, no sprout produces flour. Should any perhaps produce it, strangers themselves will swallow it down. Israel must be swallowed down. Now they must come to be among the nations like a vessel in which there is no delight. For they themselves have gone up to Assyria." You see that? They called for help to Assyria, whereas David was in the land of Judah, south of Israel, the northern kingdom. At one time, under David's rule, they were all part of the same nation of Israel, the north and the south kingdoms. And in David's time, they had sought, or they had certainly found enemies in Syria. And they themselves have gone up to Assyria in the time of Hosea as a zebra, or prior to Hosea, as a zebra isolated to itself. In Ephraim's case, they have hired lovers. Ephraim, also Ephraim being another name for Israel. "Also, although they keep hiring them among the nations, I shall now collect them together, and they will be a little while in severe pains because of the burden of king and princes." They've hired lovers. They go to Assyria. They seek allies in the north and the east, which is Assyria. "For Ephraim has multiplied altars in order to sin. He has come to have altars in order to sin. I proceeded to write for him many things of my law, just like something strange they have been accounted. As my gift sacrifices, they kept sacrificing flesh, and they kept eating what Jehovah himself, Yahweh himself, took no pleasure in. Now he will remember their error and hold an accounting for their sins. To Egypt they proceeded to return." In other words, they behaved just as though they'd never been brought out of Egypt. They still did whatever things they were doing as though they hadn't even been saved by Jehovah, as though they weren't his people. In other words, they were behaving like they were not Jehovah's people, that he had never given them the salvation by bringing them out of Egypt. And verse 14, "And Israel began forgetting his maker and building temples." Here we have a reference. Hosea's prophecy foretold that God would send a fire into the cities of Judah. "And I shall certainly send fire into his cities, and it must devour the dwelling towers of each one." Judah, for his part, multiplied fortified cities. Verse 14. So, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah's reign, also, the Assyrian king Sennacherib came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and proceeded to seize them. However, Hosea also prophesied that Jehovah would save Judah. That is a reference we'd like to look at. Hosea 1 and 7. Remember about Judah, even though he was going to use the Assyrians to exile the northern kingdom of Israel, Jehovah was going to save Judah, as he had said in the prophecy of Hosea chapter 1, verse 7. But to the house of Judah I shall show mercy. Remember, little children? To the house of Judah I shall show mercy, and I will save them by Jehovah their God, by Yahweh their God, but I shall not save them by a bow or by a sword or by war, by horses or by horsemen. There it is. You see? And in the time of Hezekiah, that prophecy came true, because do you recall, little ones, how we already read that during the time of Hezekiah, the Assyrian army had come in great numbers to the vicinity of Jerusalem in Judah, but they were driven back when 185,000 of them were put to death by the angel of Yahweh. Overnight, he wiped out their army, essentially, leaving very few remaining, and they had to return to their land, to Nineveh, where some many years later, the king, who at that time had become the king, Sennacherib, by that time he was king, at the time when he was put to death by his own sons, in the city of his own dwelling place, to which land he'd returned following this miraculous saving event of Jehovah's angel to save Judah and King Hezekiah from the Assyrian army. So he did save Judah, but he didn't use a bow or a sword or warfare or horses or horsemen. He used some kind of a miraculous destruction brought by an angel and wiped out the Assyrian army, 185,000 of them in one night. That's all for the study for the scriptures for today. We've got about less than a minute. And we've just completed Hosea chapter 1. I mean, 8, rather. And we just reviewed Hosea chapter 1 and verse 7. We just finished Hosea 8. So the total number of chapters in Hosea is 14. We'll be finishing that up in some time from now, God willing, and hopefully Yahweh is going to be with us. As long as we're with him, he will. He'll be with us. We have no time left. It's February 29, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 1955 hours Eastern Time, and I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. The time here, we just stated the time, but in my behalf, we have these timepieces, Live Dusty, and Cassie, and they're saying, bye for now.